for giving us the opportunity to speak here and also visit PI, which is always a lot of fun. I'm going to tell you about a recent paper I wrote with these two guys, Peter Tan-Hassadim and Seth Floyd, on new quantum algorithm for solving linear systems of equations. And I'm going to tell you about the problem, in case you haven't seen it before, how classical computers solve the problem, how we approach it, what the algorithm we give, the quantum algorithm we give. I'll talk a little bit about the details of the algorithm. I'll give some arguments why the algorithm probably can't be improved. And then I'll talk about some things that other people have done and some ways that we know how to, or more often would like to know how to, extend our algorithm. So so what's the problem? The problem is solving a linear system of equations. We're given A, so the matrix, which we'll assume is Hermitian and n by n. B is we're given as a vector, and we want to find some x satisfying the equation AX equals B. I've restricted A to be Hermitian, otherwise the problem is fairly general. But this is not a big restriction, because if A is not Hermitian, or not even square necessarily, this matrix is square and Hermitian. If we solve the problem with this matrix, then it gives us the answer for the original A. And why is that? Well, because AX equals B is equivalent to this equation here. You can see that the A lines up with the X and gives you the B. So because any non-square or non-Hermitian matrix can be replaced by a matrix of this form, from now on, I'll just assume that the matrix A is Hermitian. OK, so this is the problem that I'll consider today. And one thing we might like to do is to spit out the length n vector x. That's the solution. But in some circumstances, we might be content with something weaker. Maybe we want to estimate some expectation value related to x, or a sample from a probability distribution corresponding to x. So our algorithm won't actually spit out the list of numbers corresponding to x, but will be effective in doing these weaker goals. And this problem, I was going to list applications, but it appears all over the place. We've known about it for a long time, and linear systems equations occur throughout things that are done all over science, engineering, and so on. So it's broadly speaking, the problem is of interest. And if a quantum computer could help with some specific examples of it, then that would be nice. OK, so let's talk about how this problem is usually solved. The simplest sort of general purpose solution, well, the simplest is Gaussian elimination, but that's not actually the nicest. Slightly better is the LU decomposition, which the running time is basically the same as the running time of multiplying two matrices that are n by n. And there's also dependence on these two parameters, kappa and epsilon. So epsilon is a bound on the error in x. And the dependence here is pretty good, because if we want to improve epsilon, we just take more bits. And then we can get a better and better approximation of x. And so the dependence just goes like poly log epsilon. There's also this number kappa that we have to deal with, which also shows in the complexity. And kappa is something called the condition number, which is a measure of how hard the matrix is to invert. One way to think of it is it's the largest singular value of A divided by the smallest singular value of A. So if A is very close to singular, then this kappa will approach infinity. You can also write it as the product of the norm of A with the norm of A inverse. When kappa is very large, the matrix, we say, is ill-conditioned. And matrix inversion is numerically unstable. So that means that perturbing A by a little bit will change A inverse by a lot. So that means that we have to take more bits of precision to make sure that these numerical instabilities don't lead to problems. Yeah. That's a good question. So it's, I would say that it's large if it's sort of polynomial in n. In this case, that doesn't really hurt us that much, because even if it's polynomial in n, it's only going to lead to a poly log n overhead. So this LU decomposition or Gaussian elimination, those deal well even with fairly large condition numbers. You might also consider large to be even larger than that, but I would say that that is large. And that's the sort of thing that comes up in practice. So if your matrix corresponds to some you know, wave equation, and you have n modes, and they range in energy from, you know, 1, 2, 3 up to n, then your condition number will be order n, or, you know, square root of n, or something like that. So, you know, having the condition number be polynomial in n is sort of the tough thing that we might face in practice. Having the condition number be poly log n is something which is, you know, the nicer situation.
The, they would cite the something called the Hilbert matrix, mm-hmm. for example, where the condition number goes exponentially.
Right.
And they would say those are the cases of bad condition.
That's true. I guess I would call that very bad.
Okay.
But yeah, certainly you can design matrices that look particularly grisly with respect to condition. If you pick a random matrix, the condition number will be polynomial in n. Pretty much for most random ensembles you can think of. So it's this sort of, so what the condition number is really depends on the application. I think that exponentially large condition numbers, I think those are not super common. I think the most common thing to face is polynomial n. And then something which I won't really get into is there are ways of bringing the condition number down to poly log n through preconditionings, which is, you know, a whole other. That would basically be the sequel to our game, is applying this with suitable preconditionings. But Kappa will return to plague us again and again. It's the bane of numerical analysts, and that's no exception for us. Okay, so poly log Kappa doesn't look so bad, but if n is really big, we'd like our thing to run in linear time. I mean, classically, we're happy usually when our algorithms run in nearly linear time. And one way to do this, if our matrix is sparse, is with something called iterative methods. So conjugate gradient is one of them. The Krylov subspaces, there are a bunch of names for different kinds of iterative methods. What they do, the core of the algorithm involves multiplying your matrix A by some vector, and then doing vector addition and multiplication, addition, inner products, and scalar computations. And the number of matrix vector multiplications you need, if the matrix is Hermitian, goes like square root of kappa times log 1 over epsilon. So if kappa isn't too big, this can be a big advantage.
Yeah. Can both or either of these methods be designed to adapt to the condition number, or do you really have to know the condition number ahead of time?
They both should be able to. Basically, if you run it, I haven't looked into this too carefully, but they definitely, you can adapt to the condition number, because you can always, if you pick kappa too small, they won't work properly. And then you can try it again for a larger value of kappa. I don't know exactly how the details of that work, but something like that should occur. So this is matrix vector multiplications. But in particular, if A is a sparse matrix, so let's say there's at most S non-zero entries per row, then these matrix vector multiplications take time n times S. So you put this all together, and the total time is n S square root of kappa log 1 over epsilon. So if the sparsity is pretty small, and kappa is more like poly log n than like n or n squared, then this can be a nearly linear time classical algorithm to solve the problem. And this is sort of what people aim for with classical solutions to the problem. they try to manipulate the matrix in some way so that the condition number is small, and maybe it's the product of a few sparse matrices, or it's sparse itself, and then the whole thing runs in nearly linear time.
So is this close to optimal?
Yes. I'll talk more about optimality later. Certainly, if you want to print out the whole vector x, you need linear time. If you just want some feature of x, then you can't beat square root of kappa matrix vector multiplications. We give actually a convoluted proof of this, and then we found that there's a very simple proof, which is take A to be the adjacency matrix of a random cycle of length kappa. Then the condition number will be kappa, and in order to, you know, find your way around the cycle, you need I'm mixing up square root of kappa and kappa, but you need sort of at least square root of kappa multiplies in order to even see a reasonable amount of the cycle.
Yeah. So the lower bound is with respect to the kappa, but not necessarily with respect to the n, is it?
Right. So in fact, you can do, in some cases, you can get polylog n. And the reason is, if you make this many matrix vector multiplications, let's suppose that B is supported only on a few elements, let's say one element. Then once you multiply, then A times B is supported on at most s elements, and A squared times B is supported on at most s squared elements. And so the total size of the support grows to at most this size. So for small values of kappa, this could actually beat, this could actually be sublinear. So it's not automatic that you have to do order n. So at the end of the day, there's three runtimes here. There's the LU decomposition, there's the sort of standard conjugate gradient method, and then there's this sparse, the super sparse conjugate gradient, where the final support of your vector is much less than n. So there's three different runtimes. The classical runtime should be thought of as the minimum of those three. And for the parameters that we consider, it'll turn out that you can't improve on, you cannot improve on the minimum of these three classical runtimes. I'll come back to that later.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the case of the sparseness, I mean, you need the way that A is given is such that you know where the zero and just.
Yeah, so we assume there's. I said that it has these many non guarantees per row, but also I have to assume that it's row computable. So I give you a row index, and in time, let's say, order s, you can spit out the s non zero things. Yeah, that's.
Has to be a row and column?
Well, it's permission, so that's the same thing. But yeah. Okay, any more questions about the classical algorithms? So this is, this is what we want to do. And these are pretty good algorithms, so it's not automatic that it'll be possible. So our quantum algorithm, we're going to change the problem a little bit to make it more amenable. What we do is we take our input B, won't be a list of n numbers, because we're aiming for sublinear time, but it's going to be a quantum state. We assume it's a unit vector. And let's just suppose the time to repair it is this t sub b. So hopefully this won't be too large. It's basically, this is the cost of repairing the input. We again assume that A is sparse and efficiently row computable, and that all the eigenvalues lie between 1 over kappa and 1. So if not, then assume we have some bounds where we can rescale it so that it's within that range. So the condition number of this thing is at most kappa. Now, for the answer is some vector, which is not necessarily a unit vector. So let x be the unit vector proportional to the answer. Okay? And now, our algorithm will do the following. It'll give you this unit vector x, which is proportional to the right answer. It'll tell you approximately what this proportionality constant is. So for the purposes of your estimations, you can put those two together and estimate quantities that depend on x. And this will be the runtime. It's kappa times the cost of preparing b. So you could think of that as you have to start with kappa copies of b. It's not quite true, but the cost is about the same. And the runtime scales like log n S squared kappa squared over epsilon. So to contrast, these I've put up the three classical runtimes, dropping the sort of lowest order terms. And basically, our algorithm is exponentially better dependence on n, polynomially related dependence on kappa, and exponentially worse dependence on epsilon. I'm comparing now to conjugate gradient. So conjugate gradient has n, square root of kappa, log 1 over epsilon. So in some ways, we're better. In some ways, we're worse. Also, classical algorithms output the entire vector x. We give this quantum state, which is sort of encodes x. So it's sort of like trying to compare the classical Fourier transform and the quantum Fourier transform. They're analogous, but not exactly the same thing.
How many times would I have to run this if I wanted to get a classical point description of x?
Well, order n, obviously, because, yeah, so it's not suitable for producing all of x, if x is fully general. What you want to do it for is if you have to estimate some observable, like x represents wind flow, and you want to estimate one number, like how much lift is there on the airplane. No, that's the setting which you want to do. Yeah.
Okay, so I know this is one of those, you're going to talk about this later questions, but I wanted to ask you now. You mentioned that kappa for generic random matrices is poly n.
That's right.
But then you alluded to this preconditioning.
Yeah.
Can reduce it to poly log. So the short question is that a reasonable sort of thing to do that we can then wave our hands and say there's a good chance that arbitrary matrices could be preconditioned to poly log where your algorithm works?
No, you can't wave your hands and say that. It takes work, and it only happens in some cases.
Okay.
And it's sort of like ongoing research, and people get very excited when they can find a good preconditioner for a new class of matrices. On the plus side, they exist for many classes of matrices. I haven't read this paper, but for elliptical PDEs, there's good preconditioners. So it's not a given, but you get them reasonably often. So this is our runtime. You might ask, can we improve on this? You know, do we really need to have this 1 over epsilon when the classical algorithms do log 1 over epsilon? Or maybe for this restrictive task, you know, just sampling things related to x, maybe this is a weak enough task that a classical algorithm could also do it in time polylog n with these range of parameters. So part one is I'll describe the quantum algorithm that does this, and part two is I'll show that pretty much that the above is more or less optimal. You know, you can't, in general, improve this runtime, and you can't do what we do quantumly without an exponential slowdown unless classical computers, in general, can simulate quantum computers in polynomial. So when kappa is not too big, this really does give an exponential speed. So I'll return to that later. For now, I first want to describe how the algorithm works. And the algorithm really is there's some details, but the heart of it is really a cut and paste job. So the first tool that we use is Hamiltonian simulation. And this is a particular paper we want to use, but gives the most efficient construction. But other, you know, any kind of Hamiltonian simulation method will do the job. And what we want to do is we want to be able to simulate e to the iat, so Hamiltonian evolution according to the matrix A for time t. And it turns out we can do this up to this O twiddle, for meaning smaller terms, in time more or less proportional to t times log n and sparsity squared. So that's the first step, is we're going to do Hamiltonian simulation. The other tool we want to use is phase estimation. So if you have some unknown lambda, and you apply it for some time ranging from 0 to t naught, then you can estimate lambda up to an additive error of 1 over t naught. And this is a particular technique you want to use because it gives a slightly better error scaling than just doing the normal the method that people usually describe. But you know, the normal phase estimation will also do the job. And the idea is we're going to do phase estimation on e to the iat, and this corresponds to measuring approximately in the eigenbasis of A. And so if we apply this to our vector B, then we've approximately resolved it into the eigenbasis of A, because we've approximately measured this eigenvalue ramp. And we've done this coherently as well, so we're going to get an estimate of lambda, which we can then uncompute later on. And then using this estimate, we'd like to apply A inverse. So once we've diagonalized A, then applying A inverse is just applying, once we rescale suitably, a filtering operation. So it's not unitary, it won't always succeed, but with some reasonable probability, we'll be able to successfully apply it. So the way this filtering operation works is, this is what we'd like to do. We'd like to map B to, this is the successful, this means that we've successfully done matrix inversion, and there's this flag 1, which indicates we've done it. And then the rest of the amplitude goes here. The flag 0 indicates that the filtering has failed, and this is the operator that sort of fills up the rest of the space. So think of this as a coherent version of a quantum filtering where, you know, this corresponds to success and this corresponds to failure. We have to choose some constant C here so that the whole thing is a valid quantum operation, which is the same as saying that this operator has to have large eigenvalue less than equal to 1. So C is going to be, we'll see it's on the order of 1 over capital. So finally, we want to post-select. We want to measure this first qubit and hope that the answer is 1. If the answer is 1, then we're left with a state proportional to A inverse B. In other words, we're left with X. If it's 0, we've destroyed our state and we have to start over. That's not actually true. In fact, we do amplitude amplification, but what I said about post-selecting captures the spirit of it. OK, so that's the rough idea of the algorithm. I'll tell you briefly, I guess this is, I'll tell you in slightly more detail how that works. If these u's of lambda are the eigenstates of A, in general our input B is going to be some superposition over those. We start with the control register. We do Hamiltonian simulation conditioned on the control register. Then we Fourier transform it, and we get this estimate, lambda twiddle, where these coefficients, alpha, lambda, lambda twiddle, should be small unless lambda tilde is close to lambda. So our estimates are concentrated near the correct value of lambda. And now we can use our estimates to do this filter. And this just corresponds to adjoining this state. Once we measure this qubit, we'll have done the filter. Of course, we first have to undo steps 1 through 3 to erase lambda tilde and whatever other detritus came along with it. And now measuring this qubit or doing amplitude amplification on it will do the right filtering operation. That's pretty much what I said in the previous slide, just slightly more concrete. OK, any questions about how this works? So to analyze the algorithm, the Hamiltonian simulation produces error that really vanishes so quickly we don't have to worry about it. And the time is more or less proportional to T naught. And now what about T naught? Well, T naught enters into the phase estimation because the errors of that go like 1 over T naught. And if we use this Buzek et al. Phase estimation, then the tail probability dies off quickly enough that basically the things are dominated by this 1 over T naught error. This is where kappa comes in. So if we have an error in lambda of 1 over T naught, then our error in lambda inverse, just you can see by taking the derivative of lambda inverse, is lambda to the minus 2 over T naught, which is at most kappa squared over T naught. So we want this to be less than epsilon. So we take T naught to be kappa squared over epsilon. So this is all totally straightforward and easy. Finally, we have to take this number C to be 1 over 2 kappa to guarantee that this thing is less than 1 half. We could, in principle, should be able to take it all the way up to 1 over kappa, but the analysis gets far grislier when you take it close to 1, and the difference is only a constant factor of efficiency. So finally, there's this post-selection step. So the probability that it succeeds is at least 1 over kappa squared. Post-selection can also blow up errors by a factor of perhaps kappa. So naively, it looks like the runtime should be kappa to the fifth. And you know, if you want the half-page proof, then the runtime is kappa to the fifth. If you add sufficiently many pages of algebra, you get kappa squared over epsilon. But the details aren't all that interesting. We should be able to improve it further. So this paper does very clever things with using Hamiltonian simulation for variable amounts of time and patching it together. And in some cases in our algorithm, we're doing Hamiltonian simulation for varying amounts of time. You know, when you're close to the bad eigenvalues, you need a lot of precision. But when you're near other eigenvalues, maybe you need less precision. So we're not fully taking advantage of this. So we think we may be able to improve the kappa squared. And we know we can't, the only thing we know we can't do better than is square root of kappa. So it took some effort to get to kappa squared, and then we got tired, but maybe with many more pages of algebra, further improvements would be possible. Yes? When you do the phase estimation, this control register is in a superposition of time between 0 and t0. So we're doing Hamiltonian simulation for some time that ranges between 0 and t0. And then that's going to determine the accuracy of phase estimation and so on.
So how do you prove that in lower bound?
I'll get to that in a few slides. OK, so I want to say a little more about the type of solution that we come up with. So there's different ways of saying that you solve this matrix inversion problem, right? So in one sense, the best thing you can do is produce the whole vector. That's what classical algorithms achieve. Our algorithm produces this quantum superposition. And then there's even below that, there's other tasks which you might want to do. You might want to sample according to the probability distribution corresponding to the solution. Or maybe you want to estimate some expectation value. The simplest case would be if n is a diagonal matrix. So each one of these tasks is in a sense stronger than the next one. They're not strictly, you know, one and two can't be strictly compared, but they're not so far off. And so it's there's an important way, sense in which our algorithm differs from classical matrix inversion algorithms. And the way I like to think about it is in terms of classical Monte Carlo algorithms. So I would say the old-fashioned way to get an exponential speed up is not to use a quantum computer, but to use a sampling algorithm, a classical sampling algorithm. So suppose you have a probability distribution P on n objects. Well, for many purposes, you don't need to write down n numbers. It just suffices to sample according to that distribution. And then you only need log n bits. And then with these log n bits, there are many things you can do efficiently. For example, if A is a stochastic matrix and a sparse one, then you can map P to A times P. You know, this corresponds to applying a Markov chain. If you want to estimate some expectation of some value, so this quantity is sum over I, m sub I, p sub I, and these m sub I's aren't too large, then the number of samples you need only depends on the desired error. There's no n dependence there. So for many classical algorithms, you know, this is a tool that's used in order to have runtime that goes like polylog n. And so the way I like to think about our algorithm is that it's sort of like a classical sampling algorithm, except it also allows you to map, to apply not just to multiply that matrix, but to multiply by their inverses. So you can't map P to A inverse times P. You know, that's not something you can efficiently do classically. Whereas if you're working with these quantum samples, you have sort of a larger range of things you can do than you can do with classical samples. So it's just a metaphor, but I think it's this, the right spirit in which to think of this result. This also raises the question, given that there are these exponentially better classical algorithms, and given that we only need to estimate one quantity, we don't need to actually print out n numbers, can we do better classically? You know, perhaps if you only want to do this, then there's a classical polylog n time algorithm. I mean, I've already told you there isn't, but if you forgot that I told you, then this would be a possibility that you might believe. So I next want to argue why you can't, and in the process, why you also can't improve R so much. And the argument is based on, the usual way of showing lower bounds, I guess, is I'll show that this problem that we solve is, in fact, BQP hard. So it probably can't be solved efficiently on a classical computer. OK, so how does the hardness result go? Suppose we have little n qubits. We start in the all zero state. We apply t gates. Might as well have them be two qubit gates. And we measure the first qubit. OK, then I claim that this problem of estimating the acceptance probability of this circuit can be reduced to solving one of these matrix inversion problems, even in the weak sense that I've been describing. So M is a simple diagonal matrix. The starting vector is extremely simple. The dimension of A goes roughly like 2 to the n times the runtime. And kappa goes like t squared. So if t is polynomial in the number of qubits, then kappa is polylog in the matrix dimension. And so even in this case, which seems relatively easy, classical computers can't do very much. And even if they only have to estimate this number, not even to print out the whole solution. So as a corollary of this, a classical algorithm that ran in time polynomially related to R time would imply that BPP is equal to BQP. And this also implies you can't improve R runtime to anything less than square root of kappa, at least if you want to preserve the polylog n. Because if you could, then you could simulate a quantum computer, a quantum circuit of time t in time less than t. And then if you repeat that enough times, you end up simulating an arbitrary p-space circuit in quantum polynomial time. So that's also pretty unlikely. So we don't think we can do better than square root of kappa runtime for algorithm. Yeah.
You down at the bottom, you say if A is stochastic and sparse, then you can do P to AP.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to do, if for stochastic sparse matrices, if you wanted to do A inverse, couldn't you expand it in powers of 1 minus A?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that is sort of related to this BQP hardness result. The issue is that when you do that, you get negative numbers. And if you have a bunch of vectors, so suppose you weren't working with samples. Suppose you were working with vectors. Then if you have a bunch of vectors with negative entries, you can add them up, no problem. But if you have a sample, you know, you have a bunch of probability samples, and you want to combine them with negative weights, you can't do that. If you want to combine them with positive weights, you can. So, there's some variance of the problem which you can do classically. But in general, matrix inversion introduces minus signs, which, you know, by one interpretation are the essence of quantum mechanics.
So does this argument show that even the special subcase of stochastic sparse matrices could not be inverted fast classically?
I haven't thought hard about stochastic. That seems plausible. I want to say something. This metaphor is not super strict because there's a difference between L1 normalized and L2 normalized. And I haven't thought hard about that difference. It's plausible, but I haven't thought much about it. Richard?
Well, I was wondering how the corollary two, how the second corollary follows from the theorem.
So if the quantum runtime is t, then this turns into a matrix inversion problem with kappa going like t squared. So if we could solve that problem with a quantum computer in this time, kappa to the 1 minus delta over t, this would mean that quantum time t could be solved in quantum time t to the 1 minus delta. You know, maybe times some Pauli laws or something. So that's basically the idea. And then the only reason you couldn't iterate that and keep on bringing it down until you have this kind of. Maybe easier to think of a BQP space, you know. I want to say, maybe it's kind of obvious, okay, those were complexity theoretic, but you know, we can also say these relative to oracles. So relative to an oracle, you believe in those, then our can't improve the quantum algorithm. You can't even mildly improve the classical algorithm. So you can't even, you know, there's a minimum like n to the 1/3 or something. You can't go below. And iterative methods can't go below little o square root of kappa matrix vector multiplies. This is a little bit silly because there's also the example of the cycle, but it's a sign that our result can't be so far from type, that it gives the same type bound as the cycle. This also has consequences for error scale. You know that we can't get a log 1 over epsilon like all the classical algorithms, because if we could, then we could efficiently estimate very precisely the acceptance probability of a quantum circuit. And so we could count the number of solutions to NP problems. And obviously, relative to an oracle, you also rule out even mild improvements. So when you put it all together, it means that not a whole lot of improvement is possible for the regime that we're considering. The proof idea is pretty simple. I'll show you an idea that almost works, and then show you how to patch it up. If your quantum circuit, remember, is you have applied these gates, U1, U2, up to U15. We do the usual thing. You add a clock register, and you find the operator. The clock register is t dimensions. And you define this unitary uv, which adds 1 to your time and applies the appropriate unitary. And then, so v is a unitary operator. And then I define the matrix A to be identity minus e to the minus 1 over t times v. So the eigenvalues of this guy, I guess I should have written order t over there. They're at most 2, because this thing is norm at most 1. And then the eigenvalues are at least 1 over t, because we're subtracting, this thing looks pretty much like 1 minus 1 over t. So the smallest eigenvalue you can have is going to be roughly t. So the condition number of this thing is order t. It's not actually a permission, so you end up having to square that condition, which is where the t squared comes from. But you know that for now. So the main idea is that if you expand A inverse, it looks like you get this sum here, e to the minus k over t times b to the k. So think of that as applying b for some geometrically distributed amount of time. So probably you're going to apply b for sort of order t times x. You know, a good fraction of amplitude lies there. In fact, you have at least you have 1 over t amplitude in this state, which corresponds to applying v exactly t times, which is exactly means doing exactly the right computation. So your time is wrapped around, started at 1, it's wrapped around back to 1, and you've applied exactly the computation. This tells you the idea of why this simulated quantum computation. It's a pretty lousy simulation, because you only have 1 over t overlap at the state you want, and the thing keeps wrapping around. And so you get contributions from applying the circuit once, applying the whole circuit twice, applying the circuit 3 times, and so on. But it's not so hard to patch that up. You define t more time steps where you do nothing, and then t more time steps where you undo the circuit. So this has the property that when you apply all 3 t gates, you get back the identity. And if you apply any number of gates between t and 2t, then you get the desired circuit. So now, if we define v and a pretty much the same way, then
that everything works. Our state now has a constant overlap with the successful computations, because if t is any value, if little t is any value between capital T and twice capital T, then you get a successful computation. And there's no error at all introduced from the wrapper, because could give exactly uncomputed this. And so this, the fact that this reduction adds no additional error means that we can even prove these results about PP versus BQ. You know, we can even rule out very precise algorithms because there's essentially no error added by this reduction. But the details are not so important. What's important is that sort of the key idea of this whole thing is this extension rate. An inverse looks like a power series, and the terms that dominate are like V to the order kappa. And if the condition number is kappa, then that kind of looks like raising some part of the matrix to that power. So that's why it looks roughly like applying a quantum computation for order kappa type steps. So I should mention that this idea that estimating the power of a matrix is B to be complete is actually due to, or at least what we heard of it was due to these guys, which show, and that's in a sense, in spirit, similar to our BQP hardness result. And there's many works which sort of overlap with us in one idea or another. This paper uses similar phase estimation techniques to show how accessing U lets you apply U to some fractional power, U is a unitary. This is sort of an extension of our paper, which applies it to solving differential equations. And has many of the same features, which is that the scaling is very good with respect to dimension, but lousy with respect to things that classical algorithms have less trouble with. This embedding arbitrary matrices in Hamiltonians is also used effectively in this paper. So I want to close by talking about a few ways to improve our paper, some of which we've observed, some of which we haven't been able to figure out. Okay, so one thing that we do know how to deal with is the case when A is ill-conditioned. And our solution is not delightful, but it's again hard to imagine improving it by much. So suppose you have no guarantee about the low eigenvalues of A, sort of like the question Robin asked about classically. Well, we can just pick, you know, use wishful thinking and say, well, I would like the condition number to be so-and-so. And I actually only want to work with this matrix where it's well-conditioned. And for those ill-conditioned parts, I just, you know, I don't want to think about that. And so that actually works. You can invert the matrix on the well-conditioned part and then map the ill-conditioned part to some flag space. You know, you can raise a flag saying this part is ill-conditioned, this part is within the well-conditioned subspace. So that works reasonably well. The only flaw is that you can never exactly determine if an eigenvalue is greater than 1 over capital or less than 1 over capital. There has to be some window of uncertainty. So that seems to be a fundamental limitation with these algorithms, with this sort of idea. But in some, otherwise, it gives you at least a partial answer to this problem. Something which we're more embarrassed about being able to solve is the case where the largest eigenvalue of A is too large. So I've assumed that the largest eigenvalue of A is at most 1. In some sense, this is a technical assumption, because if we're larger, we can always just rescale to make the thing smaller. But what if it's much larger and it's unknown? It seems reasonable that we could do Hamiltonian simulation and just sort of forget about the eigenvalues that are too small. But there's this annoying feature of all of the known Hamiltonian simulation algorithms, which is that their error is uncontrolled. Their error doesn't promise to live within the subspace of a large eigenvector. It could also contaminate the eigenvectors with smaller eigenvectors. This seems like a technical problem. It doesn't seem like there's any reason in principle that can't be resolved. We just don't know how to do it. So it'd be nice if we could figure out how to do that. So I introduced preconditions before. Here's what they are. The idea is that B is think of it like a sort of approximation to A inverse, so that if you multiply it by A, you get a much smaller condition number. The best kind are sparse preconditioners, because those we can multiply by efficiently, and then we can, so if we have access to a sparse preconditioner, then the whole problem can run much faster. This is one of the key aspects of most successful classical algorithms, and we'd like to find examples of how this can be done quantumly on problems of interest. There's details to work through, but everything seems like it should work. And finally, you know, this is a framework for finding algorithms. There's many little details which make it so you can't just you know, take any classical algorithm which uses a matrix inverter and plug this in instead. However, we have many, there are many ideas where it should be able to offer some sort of benefit. So it'll take some work to do this, but I think it's a nice problem to work on specific cases of areas where this can offer a boost. OK, thanks for your attention.
I just have a comment about that BQP equals p-space
sort
of production. I mean, for classical computation, and I think even maybe randomized, there are these time hierarchy theorems that say, you know, that basically there are problems that you can solve in time t that you cannot in you know, t to the 1 minus delta, which is
right,
which is the kind of the consequence you get, right? Or you're sort of assuming.
Yeah, so we were looking, so my understanding was that for BQP, and I thought even BPP, no time hierarchy results were known, for some annoying technical reason. Yeah, this is a subject I'd like to know more about. I mean, it seems like everyone knows that with randomized time n cubed, you can do more than randomized time n squared. But I don't know, I don't know what rigorous statements can be made related to it. So yeah, it does seem, yeah, basically, good question. I'd like to know more about it. We don't think there's a, I didn't think there was a quantum time hierarchy theorem, but it doesn't mean that what I said is the best. Maybe you can say something stronger than that. Well, actually, yeah, relative to an oracle, you can say strong things. Mm-hmm. The problem is, if BQP were to equal P space, then you could do the thing that I was trying to rule out. Right? If BQP were to equal P space, you know, you could invert ill-conditioned matrices in a small amount of time. So, so you know, in that sense, you know, I think that's sort of the right thing to say there. Although it's possible that, I guess for a time hierarchy theorem, you have to somehow let the number of qubits grow or involve a Turing machine in some way rather than quantum circuits. But yeah, maybe afterwards we'll talk about it more.
So just to be clear, the regime that this algorithm performs well on is when the condition number and the sparsity are polylog n?
That's right. Yeah, that's when they would, you know, offer an exponential.
And from your future work, you're saying if there's some problems where on the face of it, those parameters are in the range you want them to be, but you have to be a bit more careful because you have to look at the best classical algorithm for that problem, not just for solving linear.
I would say on the face of it, the parameters are not where we want, but with a preconditioner, you can make them where we want. And so then there's a bunch of little steps to look at and to make sure that these steps essentially have to be done in parallel, right? And they can't rely on ever writing down a list of n numbers. So that's what we have to check. I'm not really an expert on what practical problems use matrix inversion, period. So I shouldn't say that the condition number is always large. That was just my impression. There could be many classical problems out there where the condition number happens to be poly log n without any extra effort. I just don't know of it, but I'm hoping to be proven wrong.
Usually found in numerical scientific calculations, right?
Right.
Where you're trying to solve a partial differential equation and so on.
Right. So for all the ones I can think of, the condition number goes, like a polynomial, cube root or square root or something like that. But that could be because I haven't seen too many of them. I should say also, the work I'm most aware of on preconditioners is by Dan Spielman, who's been showing that a very large variety of matrix problems can be effectively preconditioned. I guess that's sort of the next thing that we're going to look at. Daniel?
Well, I just was going to see if there are any further questions.
Just one more remark. I think Jim Demel at Berkeley has been working on something related to condition numbers and so on. I forget what exactly it is. It's been a while.
Okay, cool. Let's talk about it.
And if that's it, let's thank Armageddon.